admit that. All right. Essays on Prophecy, Lecture 16. I've entitled this The Flying Sorcerers. All right, Flying Sorcerers.
Oh, that's clever.
So let us open our Bibles and begin to expand the parameters of our ignorance. In the previous Lecture 12 in this series, entitled The Ark of the Covenant Part 3, I stated the following. Quote, the cherubim are involved in maintaining a cosmic or astrological balance in creation. But when we deal with cherubim, we are also dealing with the untapped power of absolute atomic decimation. Jewish commentator Rashi says the cherubim are specifically angels of destruction. This view becomes paramount when we read the prophecies of Daniel relating to the abomination that causes desolation. I then ask the question, what could be so abominable about one of God's own holy angelic creatures? Unquote. Now, I might also ask the further glaringly obvious question, what is the connection prophetically to cherubim, being angels of destruction and the abomination that causes desolation? I don't know why people don't make a connection there when they read Daniel to the cherubim.
They say it's the Antichrist. People say that.
Well, in a sense it is.
Chapter 5.
I hope to answer these questions in this current lecture. But before I attempt to accomplish this, in our immediate past lecture, I shared 24 largely unknown prophecies that have yet to come to pass before the Messiah can even think of returning to establish the government of God, the kingdom of God. And remember, the gospel is the gospel of the kingdom of God. People forget that. It's all about give your heart to Jesus and you're going to go to heaven. But there's more to it than that. There are many more predictions that I did not include. Most prophetic commentators, ministers of the Christian faith, and elders of sectarian divisions of churchianity are totally ignorant of these destined events. Tragically, even the vast majority of rabbis of all Jerusalem's divisions do not really know what is contained in their own prophetic scrolls. You might say, well, why is that so? Let me tell you why that is so. That is so because it is primarily due to the fact that these rabbis view the scrolls of the prophets as having had their fulfillment in millennia past. And they see no real significance to their application and or replication in today's modern world. I also quoted from a Christ-rejecting rabbi who has publicly stated, quote, I'm super excited because what we're experiencing these days, the incredible miraculous attack the Israeli army is perpetrating against Iran and the incredible success they're having, it's all God's miracles. I agree with that. It's all God's miracles. Totally. But then he says, this is the last box that had to be checked. The last thing that had to happen before Mashiach comes. This attack on Iran, we're really, really ready for the Mashiach because nothing else has to happen. Nothing has to happen. Exclamation mark. As I said in the last lecture, it's all a bunch of cabbage. They don't know from cabbage. They just don't know. He's dead wrong. Christian and messianic podcasters who listen to him will be caught, as it were, with their pants down when these other largely unbeknown predictions begin to morph into a remarkable eventful fruition. The world may lie in darkness, but we at BRI-IMCF will not be caught unawares. Question. Are we preparing ourselves psychologically for the coming great false flag that will be sprung upon the entire earth in the near future? It's entirely one thing to know about it, and quite another to actually be prepared for its advent. In fact, billions will be unprepared. An enormous deception is in the wind, and it is Yehovah God who is sending that strong delusion. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 11. It comes not from the devil, it comes from God. This is, you see, this is the plan of God. What we see around us is the plan of salvation. God has no other plan, it's the plan of salvation. What we see is the outworking of that plan. People look out and go, oh, it's such a horrible plan. Yes! It's not a dream image, it's a nightmare. But it's God's nightmare, if you want to put it that way.
Don't we do the same things creatively? People write books or scripts or, yes. And it's always a terrible thing that's happening in the middle of it all. And
but it all works out at the end.
Yeah, it's sort of.
So, usually.
Some
unless you're rushing.
It's not always galloping off into the sunset. And no. So.
And as long as it's not a Russian play or a Russian... It's nothing more morbid or
that was great. That
depressing than great. Sitting through a Russian play. It's just look. Personal confession here. I had a Russian girlfriend long before the Robinson. Long, long before then. Way back in the 1960s, a Russian girlfriend, Ira Tomchik, and she was just lovely. But you know what? Her family, unfortunately, were Russians, of course. And boy, you don't know from Russians if you've never met one. It's another story altogether. Another story altogether, because things that turn out really well end up being depressing. It's just in their nature. Anyway.
It's been a long, hard road.
It has.
Yo-ho, heave-ho.
So an enormous deception is about to take place. God's sending it in order to usher into an existence the conclusion of his intention, his plan, his program, his arrangement, his organization, his design, his purpose of salvation for planet Earth and indeed for the entirety of the universe. Yehovah God is sovereign Lord of all, and his superintendence of the entirety of the cosmos is salvific. We can never get away from that.
Yeah.
God in his nature is salvific, which is revealed daily by his character and his nature, and most certainly in his love and his grace. We know the whole world will be duped, at least initially, by the counterfeit Christ on his white steed. The first of the four horses of the apocalypse, the rider carrying a bow but missing arrows from his quiver. And remember in Matthew 24, the very first sign that Christ gave of the signs of the end was false religion. False religion. Many would come. He said myriads would come saying, I am the Christ. Yes. And deceive everyone. People say, oh, that means people come along saying that I personally am Christ. No, he's saying that those people are going to come and they're going to present Christ. They're saying, Jesus is the Christ. But then they're going to lead people astray. And boy, has that been the case?
Yeah.
Absolutely. As the prime ambassador for world peace and disarmament and galloping with chilling momentum into our reality with the answers to our planet Earth's present dilemmas, his impact on the world stage will be immensely provocative. The Robertson was only saying just recently, and I agree totally with it, if he's going to solve the world's problems, then probably the problems that have been created will already have a solution that only he or the top echelons of governance know about. We know nothing about those problems to be solved, but he will come and he will have the answers to world problems. And he will solve those world problems. He arrives as the counterfeit Mashiach. But the same rider brings upon his devotees, after world acceptance and in his wake, the apocalyptic horror of global war. That's the second horseman. The resultant spread of famine. That's the third horseman. And the stench of death. The fourth horseman of the apocalypse. These are not four different riders. It is the single rider who is being revealed in his four progressive, monstrous, consequential outcomes of his reign in the arena of world politics. Claiming to be the returned Messiah, His arrival apparently transpiring immediately after the longed-for manifestation of the so-called Third Temple in Jerusalem, and possibly subsequent to the Israeli civil war which will occur over the identity and person of the God-man Yeshua, a counterfeit reproduction of the messianic government of God will be impressed upon the entire globe. We shall all be in one way or another confronted by this impending terror. We can't escape it. We can't escape it. But that great deception that's coming on the world is a false flag. They will think it's the returning Christ, but it won't be. In his parables, Christ seems to indicate that when he returns, the world will be functioning in ordinary, even daily, boring ways. Now, we are led to believe that the whole place is going to be in chaos and wars and fighting and atom bombs going off. But if you turn over to Matthew 24, and look at verse 40 and 41. Two shall be in the field. One will be taken, the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill. One shall be taken, the other left. Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord does come. In other words, life will be going on normally. As Paul said, marrying and giving in marriage. Yes, at the very end of the age, things will just be normal. At the very, very end.
As it was in the days of Noah.
As it was, well, everybody was rejoicing and so on until the flood came and took them all away.
Yeah, the church is tied in with the rapture.
Yes, evil. Mm. It says when the Lord comes, when your Lord does come. That's talking about his second coming, not a secret rapture. And also in Luke 17, yeah, turn over to Luke 17. Verse 34. This is how it shall be, verse 30, when the Son of Man is revealed. In that day he which shall be in the housetop and his stuff in the house, let him not come down. Verse 34. I tell you, in that night there shall be two men in one bed. I suppose that's said in respect of the gay movement, I don't know.
No.
The one shall be taken, the other shall be left.
Beds were shorter, short in those days.
Two women shall be grinding together. I heard a whole sermon many years ago about two women grinding together and talking about the fact that lesbianism is going to be rampant at the end of, and I just sat there and laughed, and people looked around at me and said, oh, you're laughing. Anyway. Two women shall be grinding together. The one shall be taken and the other left. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, the other left. They answered and said to him, where, Lord? Yeah, where have they been taken to? And he said to them, wheresoever the body is, there will the eagles be gathered together. All right? Think about that. But as the Antichrist will emulate Yeshua's intentions, the Antichrist will arrive with a parallel visitation of Satan's military forces, pretending to personify, in actual fact, the second coming of Christ. Menacing metallic chariots as disc-like saucers in their hundreds of thousands will have encircled the planet, and alien greys, the flying sorcerers, will masquerade as the angels of Christ to the masses, shape-shifting by nature and adopting human form and most likely shining as light. Yes, 2 Corinthians 11, verse 14, they come as angels of light. These aliens will even be capable, in my humble opinion and belief, of inculcating and impersonating via their demonic energy the identities and personalities of people who have previously died as Christians, as authentic believers. The entire imposed conceptualization will be nothing more than an elaborate deception or hoax, a huge diabolic lie. But the world will fully believe that lie. That's scary, but that's coming. The apostles warned us about this scenario eventuating, as did our Lord Yeshua. But most of us have been, and some of us will continue to be, utterly unconvinced until they actually see it with their own eyes. But by then it may be well too late to prepare spiritually against it. What I want to do now is to turn back to the 6th century BCE. Because that's when an event took place, recorded by the prophet Ezekiel, which will have violent repercussions in respect of the coming third temple in Jerusalem. Now, we're very close to that building of the temple. They've even made all the equipment and vessels and so on and so forth, dresses and so on, from the Talmudic instructions for the priesthood. And they've even created a counterfeit ark, which is an abomination in itself, with little cherubs on there. It's pretty sad, even if it is very golden and very attractive, it's pretty sad. And of course they've been saying that, you know, Texas has sent all these red heifers over to Israel. Well, just the other day the rabbinic authorities negated the whole lot of them, because they are just not up to the standard of what a 3-year-old or a younger than 3-year-old heifer should be. The red heifer has to be spotless. It has to be red. It has to be completely red. Well, one had a grey hair. Oh, that was the end of that. Another one had a white hair. End of that. One had a problem with a crack on its hoof. End of that. No, they've got to be immaculate. And indeed, they've all been disqualified. So everyone's going, oh, where are we going to get another red heifer? Well, it's going to be born in Israel, so, you know, sooner or later, they'll get one. But it won't be for a little while, for sure. But an important but largely unknown situation was unearthed by the late American biblical scholar Dr. Ernest L. Martin. I've mentioned him many times here over the decades. I am indebted to this mentor for his shared knowledge on this occasion as we reflect on the contents of Ezekiel 28. For it was Martin who comprehended and was largely in agreement with me that Satan is nowhere to be found in Ezekiel 28, nor, for that matter, in Isaiah 14. But that a cherub is most certainly a dominant force with which to be reckoned. And further, that this cherub, named Moloch, if you turn to Amos 5.26, you just make a mental note on paper, I mentioned it in the announcements, but Amos 5.26 talks about the cherubim, had rebelled against the creator God, Yehovah, disqualifying itself from Israel's temple participation in Jerusalem. Now, most people don't realize that, but I understood it, Ernest Martin understood it, and I don't know how many other people understood, probably very few. Indeed, Itiobulus, or as Josephus called him, Itiobulus II, the king of Tyre, in economic association with the kingdom of Judah, was virtually possessed by the overshadowing of this particular cherub, so much so that Ezekiel sees its destiny as transcending and dwarfing that of the actual king. Because as you read through Ezekiel 28, you'll find that it's all about Itiobulus. But then when you get down to halfway through the chapter, he suddenly talks about a cherub, an anointed cherub. So, from Ezekiel 28, verse 11, and especially from and inclusive of verse 14, the word of the Lord is focused on this exceptional cherub and not so much on the Tyrian despot. On this perception, I am in complete agreement with my late friend, Ernest Martin. It was during the axial period that Itiobulus rose to power. This powerful monarch situated his political and economic base of operations in the wealthiest metropolis of the Mediterranean coastal region, the ancient city of Tyre. In its heyday, Ezekiel informs us, it possessed an economic status that was unequaled. If you look at Ezekiel 27, verses 3 through to 7. I won't turn there. You can make a mental note on paper and look there later. Tyre was perfect in beauty. That's what it says. Perfect in beauty. Every nation on earth at one time or another had maritime intercourse with its Aryan Phoenician ports. Again, Ezekiel 26:17 and Ezekiel 27:9-25 talks about that. So wealthy and influential was this maritime sea power, Tyre became a synonym for the end time beast system and is referred to as such in the prophets. This man, Ichthyophilus, thought of himself as a god. Ezekiel 28 verse 2 makes that very plain. In fact, you might just check that one out. Ezekiel 28 verse 2. The word of the Lord, the word of Yehovah, came to Ezekiel saying, Son of man, say unto the prince of Tyrus, or Tyre, this is what the Lord God says, because your heart is lifted up, and you have said, I am a god. I sit in the seat of God, in the midst of the seas. Yes, Tyre was a city-state in the midst of the seas. It was like a port that was out, had an outgrowth from the coast into the ocean, out there, into the Mediterranean Sea. And that's where all the nations of that area would come and revitalize all their needs and so on and so forth. Very, very prosperous. He says, I sit in the seat of God in the midst of the seas. And God says, yet you are a man and not God, though you have set your heart as the heart of God. Incredible. Mm-hmm. What an ego, basically. What an ego. Certainly his exploits were so far flung all over the region, his mastery and dominion became legendary. Again, look at verse 18 and 19, if you're still in Ezekiel 28. He says, you have defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities, by the iniquity of your traffic. Now, of course, if you've got a King James Version, traffic in the old days meant commercial enterprises and centre of wealth.
Trade.
Therefore, he says, while I bring forth a fire from the midst of you, it shall devour you, bring you to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all them that behold you. And all those who know you among the people shall be astonished at you. You shall be a terror, and never shall you be any more. Yes, he's going to finish him off. So, the prophet Ezekiel made him the object of God's derision. Ezekiel's pronouncements against the prince of Tyre. In Hebrew, Tyre is the word for is a word meaning rock. Actually, they begin in Ezekiel 26. So if you want to know about Ichthyophilus, you go back to Ezekiel chapter 26. Don't just stay in 28. Go back to where it starts, in Ezekiel 26, carrying right on through to Ezekiel 28:19. And most students of the biblical revelation have been programmed to erroneously jettison chapter 28:1-19 from the entire prophecy concerning Ichthyophilus. And this has proven to be a disastrous error when it comes to interpreting the identity of the regnal individual under discussion in Ezekiel 28. For most people see, or want to see, Satan the devil lurking somewhere in this chapter. While the Dark Lord is most certainly absent from the revelation of Ezekiel, Ichthyophilus is clearly and incontrovertibly linked to a cherub. We can't overlook that. And Satan the devil is most assuredly not a cherub. Yeah. He's just not. People overlook that. Okay. Now, I had previously written at length in a BRI exposition, which many here would already have copies of, centered on the contents of Ezekiel 28. And I included aspects of this focus in my lecture 8 of the series of Daniel. When I did the series on Daniel, that's going back quite a few years now. Oh my. And that the subject under discussion in Ezekiel 28 is a man, not Satan the devil. And I stand by that earlier appraisal. The location of the Ezekielian dirge is Tyre, a wealthy city-state. I repeat, a city-state, not God's heaven. The nations with whom, and no apologies to the Seventh-day Adventists who believe the opposite, The nations with whom Tyre was trading, or at least the nations in the immediate region, under Itiobulus, are even named: Egypt, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, Dedan, Tarshish, Syria, Damascus, Judah, Israel, Sheba. His commercial activities were interlinked with all these trading partners and are mentioned in Ezekiel 27 by name. Eden was also given prime mention by Ezekiel as a luxurious region that had benefited from trade with Tyre. Eden, an area in the 6th century BCE, not the Garden of Eden, but an area that was extant with commercial interests at the time of the 6th century BCE, and it was called Eden. And you can check that out in Ezekiel, I'm not turning there, but you can check it out in Ezekiel 27, verse 23, 28, 13, chapter 31, verse 9, verse 16, verse 18, and chapter 36 of Ezekiel, verse 35. The time of the prophecy is self-evidently the axial period of world history, the 6th century before Mashiach, not sometime prior to the start of human history. Mm. That's a nonsense. We've got to root it out of our brain memory banks. Get rid of it. The great ruler of Tyre could do nothing wrong in his financial and economic dealings with the foreign powers with whom he had mutually beneficial trading alliances. As far as economic capital was concerned, this king had a golden touch. Have a look at Ezekiel 28 again, verse 4. Ezekiel 28, verse 4. God says, "With your wisdom and with your understanding, you have gained to yourself riches and have gained to yourself gold and silver into your treasury. By your great wisdom and by your traffic," again, remember, 1611 term meaning economic trading, commercial activities and practices.
The art of the deal.
The art of the deal. The art, I love it. "I have increased your riches," unquote. So did this maritime expert give all the glory to Israel's God for the blessings that came his way by the application of God's success principles? Did he visit the temple in the Holy Land and offer sacrifices in the court of the Gentiles? Absolutely not. Instead, he even in some unknown manner defiled his own sanctuaries, his own sacred spaces. He defiled them. We don't know how, but it says he defiled them. If you look at verse 18 of Ezekiel 28, "You have defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities, by the iniquity of your economic maritime commerce." In such a case of as above, so below, King Itiobulus was merely acting out in an earthly sense the very thing for which his heavenly cherub had already shown himself to be previously proven guilty. Moloch had already defiled his sanctuary in the temple of God in Jerusalem. And whatever it was, because we don't know, but whatever it was that Moloch accomplished that defiled God's sanctuary, it certainly will have implications in real time just ahead of us now. You'll see why in a minute. So now I want to jump ahead from the 6th century BCE, axial period of world history. I'm going to jump ahead to the end of days ahead of us now. Please grasp this insight. Just as Itiobulus of Tyre was obsessed by a fallen cherub, so also the man of sin, the Antichrist, at the end of the age will be obsessed by the same dark force. How do I know this? Let me tell you how I know this. While Ezekiel 28 speaks of Itiobulus, the tyrant king of Tyre, verse 14 and the latter portion of verse 16 perfectly blend the two personalities of Itiobulus and the anointed cherub as one. The same will hold true of the Antichrist and the beast from the abyss. That's how I know. Revelation 17, verse 8, talking about the beast from the abyss. Revelation 17, verse 8, the Antichrist was and is not and yet is. And this has confused so many people. They say, what the dickens is that all about? That is, he was. That is, the seventh king or president of the world federal state, as explained in Revelation 17, verse 11. And is not, well, he may well be assassinated. Now, in the old days, when I did the lectures on Daniel and the apocalypse, the six years on the apocalypse, I said that the Antichrist would be assassinated and would be miraculously healed. I can't prove that. So I admit now that I can't prove that. It's taken a few decades, but I finally admit I can't prove that. So he may well be assassinated. Hear me. He may well be assassinated, although I am speculating at this juncture. For everybody listening to this overseas and throughout Australia on the recording, it's a speculation, this section. So he is the beast that was and is not. Then it says, and yet is. So perhaps, here I go again, perhaps, this is speculation, perhaps he has been brought back to life to become the eighth king or president of the New World Order, as seems to be corroborated in the same text. All right, so I'm being very careful here. John further describes him as the beast that was and is not and shall ascend out of the abyss. Now, please notice this. He ascends, the beast ascends out of the bottomless pit, which is the abyss. And the abyss is the Mediterranean Sea. Even on the public side, I've got a video up there, or is it on YouTube, which talks about, you know, what is the abyss? And I talk about what the abyss is, the ocean, and so on. The further down you go, the more demonic the fish become in their look, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about, apparently, and again I'm speculating, apparently the Mediterranean Sea. Revelation 13, 1-3 talks about the sea. What sea is that? So, conclusion, the beast is therefore a spirit creature. So the beast that is coming is, and of course beast is the King James Version's thing, but other translations have living wild creature or wild animal. Yes. The beast is therefore a spirit creature, namely the Jerusalem temple cherub. Mr. Antichrist will also identify with military, nuclear power and might. He has previously sought to disarm the world. We saw that in Revelation 6, verse 2. A bow, but his quiver is empty of arrows. Placing all military might in the hands of the world federal state. Revelation 13, verse 4. Who can fight against the beast, right? And is in league with an alien. Now, I have brought this fact out to the attention of my students over decades, with whom he showers all sorts of sensory gifts. If you turn to Daniel 11, this is ignored by just about everybody, but I want to remind people about this. Daniel 11 and verse 39 is rather interesting. If we go back to verse 36, talking about the Antichrist, verse 36, the king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. Yeah, even Paul says that's what he's going to do in the temple of God. And shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods. Yes, even Yehovah, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. And shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished. For that is determined, shall be done. Yeah, Daniel's angel is saying, listen, we may not like it, but this is God's plan. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, and that shows immediately that the guy is Jewish, nor the desire of women. Now they go, oh, he's homosexual. No, not necessarily. He might be, but that doesn't prove it, because the desire of women was the phrase given about Tammuz. Or Nimrod. He was the desire of women. Nor regard any god. For he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces. Now, the rabbis look at that and they say, well, forces. They can be dark forces, cosmic forces. They can be munitions. It can be weaponry. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God. Please notice that. An alien. Whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land of Israel for gain. And God has said, do not divide my land. If this alien that is in a prison somewhere, in a fortress, and is being appeased by the man who is to become the Antichrist, is going to have a lot of power over the land of Israel in order to divide it for personal gain. An alien creature. So he is in league with an alien with whom he showers all kinds of sensory gifts. That same alien will enter this man wholly and bodily. Where demons normally attach to neural pathways of the human brain, and therefore the victim of demonic power becomes obsessed, in this special case, our victim, the Antichrist, becomes literally possessed. Just as Judas was possessed by Satan. Satan is not omnipresent. Not like Christ. Not like the Spirit of God. In the case of Judas, he entered bodily into him. It was a very rare occasion for that to happen. When you see demonic possession, you need to change the word possession to obsession, because they attach not to human beings inside them, normally, qualifying it, but they attach to neural pathways and can interfere with you through epilepsy, Tourette's, other kinds of abnormal behaviour, and so on and so forth. The voice in my head says, indeed, this will be a rather unique instance where an entirely new creature will result. Nothing less than a creature of mercurial plasticity and fluidity. A cybernetic organism. A cyborg. He will become immediately a hideous beast or wild animal, which the Greek itself implies. He will magnify himself above all and become the abomination that desolates or devastates. Biblical descriptions of cherubim are hideous depictions. This alien will be Moloch. I'll prove this in a second. I have shown in previous lectures that Israeli archaeologists will soon locate the Ark of the Covenant, which was hidden by Jeremiah. It will be set up in a restored temple in Jerusalem, not the counterfeit Ark that our friend Avi Abelow and others, you know, are talking about with great excitement. And I can understand that excitement. I cannot enter the joy of it because it's a counterfeit. It is the Ark which the Antichrist will desire for his own personal gain, and I've shown that in previous lectures. There is every indication from the biblical revelation that the cherubim which dominated the Ark will also be found. Of course, if they find the Ark in that cave on Mount Nebo, they're going to find the other things that were also associated with the Ark, which Jeremiah, it says in Maccabees, buried there, including the curtains and so on and so forth, but also the cherubim. If this turns out to be the case, there may be a possibility that one of them, now hear me very clearly here, one of them, and recall that these cherubim are rather large figures, they're massive, is perhaps irreducibly and irreparably broken into pieces. Daniel seems to indicate that only one cherub will be restored to the Holy of Holies. So if they find the Ark of the Covenant, but only they take the Ark back to go into the temple, and one cherub, that indicates to my mind, the other one is irreparably damaged. Perhaps because it's been now over 2,000 years and 2,500 years, earthquakes in the area, anything's possible. But only one cherub will be restored to the temple. And I don't know why people haven't seen it before, but there you go. Daniel seemed to indicate only one cherub will be restored to the Holy of Holies. He freely uses the term abomination, Daniel 9:27, toiva in Hebrew. And as every Jewish rabbinic scholar knows, the word abomination, toiva, is everywhere used in the Bible meaning idol. And make no mistake, the cherubim in the temple were idols, albeit God-ordained images. Amos 5:26 tells us that at that time period, God was angry with Israel when he banished them from the land because they had made a little Ark of the Covenant with Moloch and Kiyun, these idols, and they were walking around with them and parading themselves with them, just like the Greeks in the 1st and 2nd century AD would have their amulets, usually sexual in origin, and they'd have them as earrings or whatever, and God condemned all that. So the Jews were having little phylacteries and tefillin made of these little idols. You know, when Jews go bad, they go bad in a big way. In a big way.
Very bad.
Very bad. So, they were God-ordained images. It was in the days of King Nebuchadnezzar and the Tyrian Ichabodus II that Moloch, one of the very cherubs appointed to watch over the Ark and the Holy of Holies, rebelled against God, aligned himself to the Tyrian despot. And that same cybernetic organism, will illegally re-enter the so-called third temple at the end of the days. See, if he's rebelled against God and banished, and he goes over to the Tyrian king and becomes one with him, his cherub, what's he do later? Well, we don't know what he does later, but we do know that this creature is presented back into the temple with the ark, because he's the sole cherub left, because the other one was broken into pieces, apparently. I say apparently, because there's no indication of what happened to the other cherub. But he will emerge with the Antichrist, becoming a hideous beast or wild animal, which the Greek implies, and in so doing, the cyborg Antichrist becomes the abomination that desolates or devastates. Now, what I want everyone to notice is that way back in Ezekiel 9, most important, a cherub is mentioned in connection with the launch of the Great Tribulation. Intriguingly, this mention is also in relation to the great fast day of the Jews, Yom Kippur. And what occurs takes place in the Jerusalem temple at the end of the age. And, of course, this also had a previous fulfillment in the days of Ezekiel himself, and I think we all understand that fact. I think we're all familiar with the cyclical view of prophecy and history, at least I hope we are. Ezekiel sees the glory of God depart from the temple complex. I want you to turn to Ezekiel chapter 9. I want you to notice this very important statement, because most people don't read their Bibles, and those that do haven't got a clue what they're reading. They don't even know the period in which Ezekiel wrote, who he was contemporary with, and whether the prophecies of that time period were fulfilled or not, and if they are, were they going to be fulfilled again? But have a look at Ezekiel chapter 9, verse 3, because Ezekiel zeroes in on the Holy of Holies and witnesses the ominous act of God's Shekinah leaving the cherub upon whom it rested. Now notice it, this is yet future. And the glory of the God of Israel, that's the Shekinah glory, was gone up from the cherub. Notice, singular. Singular. Whereupon it was to the threshold of the temple. Intriguing. Intriguing. The beginning of the tribulation in the future has to do with a cherub. When the glory of the God of Israel goes up from off the cherub. Why? Because God had rejected the cherub. Which one? Moloch. This text does not state that God's glory removed from the cherubim, plural, which covered the Ark of the Covenant.
That's what I've got in mind.
Oh, no, don't tell me. Really?
Yeah.
That's cherub, singular. It says the Shekinah rose up on the cherub. What does this mean? Why didn't Ezekiel refer to the angelic presence in the plural as it should have been the case? You know, Ezekiel fastidiously recorded each movement in Exodus from Israel of God's spiritual presence in its different stages. He was very particular how he talked about the Shekinah of God. Have a look at Ezekiel 9 again, verse 3. Well, we've just been there. Let's have a look at chapter 10, Ezekiel chapter 10, verse 18 and 19. Then the glory of the Lord, that's the Shekinah glory, departed from off the threshold of the house and stood over, and notice this, the cherubims. That's back there in that period of time in the 6th century BCE. And the cherubims lifted up their wings, mounted high up from the earth in my sight. And when they went out, the wheels also that were beside them, everyone stood at the door of the east gate of the Lord's house, that's the temple, and the glory of the God of Israel was over them from above. Yeah, he said, this is the same living creature that I saw under the God of Israel by the river of Kiba, and I knew that they were the cherubim. All right, so yes, so he's very clever, he's very circumspect about talking about every movement in Exodus from Israel of God's spiritual presence in different stages. Look at chapter 43 of Ezekiel, and again, this is the historical side of Ezekiel, but again, it shows that he is very particular about every instance of the movement of the cherubim. Ezekiel 43, verse 2. Behold, the glory, that's a Shekinah, of the God of Israel came from the way of the east, and his voice was like the noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. It was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, that's the original vision on the river Kibar, even according to the vision I saw when I came to destroy the city, and the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kibar, and I fell upon my face. And the glory of the Lord came into the house, that's the temple, by the way of the gate whose prospect is toward the east. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. In other words, what we're looking at here is his meticulous eye to duty, to recording what happens with the Shekinah glory of God in relation to the cherubim of the time period. So if he's that specific on that, he is very specific about the Shekinah rising up from the cherub singular, even though some translators have gone ahead and made it plural, just to confuse the issue even more.
Probably because it's plural further on.
So yes, so they've interpreted. And the trouble is with translation, too many scholars interpret as they translate. And this is something that scholars slip into. A presumption comes into this, and assumption. It all comes into that. Interpretation is not necessarily translation. I do it sometimes. I go, well, hang on a minute. No. Because it's easy to do. So, question. Had something negative occurred which involved one of the sacred cherubim and that dwelt in the temple of God in the very holy of holies, in which presence was symbolically represented by the gold-covered angelic figures with huge wingspans hovering over the mercy seat? That's my question, and the answer is yes. Whatever has happened, by the time we get to Ezekiel 28, we find a cherub, singular, associated with the egocentric Etiopolis, the king of Tyre. And not only so, this cherub is described by the prophet as the anointed cherub that covers.
Yeah.
So there's no getting away from it. This cherub is the one that was over the ark and the mercy seat with a huge wingspan of 15 feet. I mean, you know, cherubs? Little babies? No. This thing was monstrous. By such an identification, we know it is one of the temple cherubim. How do we make the identification fit? Well, it both outstretches or outspreads in its anointed purpose its wings. And furthermore, its work is to cover. He covers. He's the cherub that covers. That is, he covers the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. But it's not in the temple of God. And it's not in the Holy of Holies. And it's not anywhere in Jerusalem. It's in the camp of Etiopolis in Tyre. Showing that's what happened. It was expelled by God from his presence, for some violation. We don't know what it was. I'd like to know. My inquisitive nature says, well, why? What did he do to upset God so much that God said, get out of my sight? So, it's in the camp of Itiobolus. This cherub has apostated from all that is holy, from all that is associated with God. A pagan emperor has become the mouthpiece for an angel of God, a cherub of God, an emperor who is soon to descend into his own private mental hell. Yeah, he went mad. Duh. That's what happens when God leaves you. You're going nuts. Not only is this the case, but now we can better appreciate the reference Daniel makes to the end time abomination of desolation in Daniel 9:27. And for the overspreading, for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate. There it is. Or as it is in the Jewish Publication Society version, upon the wing, near the wing, of detestable things shall be that which causes appallment. Yes, that is to God. I'm appalled at this. Yeah. Overspreading. Wing. Whatever the case, it refers specifically to the cherub who was entrusted with the covering of the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies.
It's reminding me of churches and their hierarchy, where they, the Protestant churches, yeah, and different Pentecostal churches and so forth that we've been associated with for one reason or another, or in a way.
Yeah.
And their question is always, so who's your covering?
Yes.
Oh, our covering is, yes. Yes, and which explains why when you go into churches, different ones, they feel different.
Yes.
That's right. Spidey senses are,
well,
happening. It belongs, because it belongs to a
spirit.
A spirit.
Exactly. You can go into Revelation chapter 2 and 3 and see that, you know, each of the messengers over each ecclesia is an angel. This is why you can go into one congregation and go, ah, it's so warm in here, it's so lovely, and everyone vibrant spirit, and it's really nice. You can go into another church and you go, oh, I'm not going back there, it's too ice cold. No, but it's aloof. It's the angel over the denomination or the church that has this exuding of energy that is adopted by the congregation,
which is its covering. And then they will say that, oh, it's the denomination. Yes, that's right. It is the denomination, exactly.
I remember Len McGee telling, oh, shouldn't have mentioned his name, but I said it now. And yes, so it's in the AOG, and he said, you know, where are your coverings? And I said, no. I don't want any covering. Christ is my covering. I don't want a covering. Mm-hmm. Covering is demonic. He looked at me like horrified. No, the only covering entirely mentioned in the Bible is the cherub. That was in rebellion against God.
Yeah, well, trust the world's trust churches to grab hold of.
Yeah,
that
they grab hold of a covering. I'll be your covering. No, I'll tell you what. I'm nobody's covering here either.
Yeah, they talk a lot about the covering of the blood of the Lamb.
Yeah, as I said, Christ is my only covering.
Mm.
Yeah. But that covering is so good that it literally eats away the sin. There's nothing left of the sin. So, reconstructing our past. In this axial age of world history, because we're in it, with AI and all the rest of it that's going on at the moment, in this axial age into which we have finally entered, thousands of researchers around the globe are currently reviewing our ancient historical roots, and they are redefining our reality, which is something we should all accomplish. The further back into the past we travel, the more unique enlightenment we are experiencing. As I have quoted from Job, I again repeat, if you want to look at it as I share this, in Job chapter 8, verse 8 and 9. Job chapter 8, verse 8 and 9. Because let's face it, the scroll of Job is the earliest document in the Bible. It predates the Torah by many years. For inquire, I pray thee, of the former age, and prepare thyself to the search of their fathers. For we are but of yesterday, and we know nothing, because our days upon earth are a shadow. And this is why I've had such a great interest in history. And I will continue to research into the past because it carries the seeds of the future.
Mm, that's why the devil's systematically causing different races of people to get rid of their past.
Oh, very much so.
Create a new one because the past was bad. Yeah, we must erase it.
Sure. Paul says, forgetting those things that are behind, people say, forget our genealogy, it's not important. Well, hang on a minute, yes it is. Not for any ego purpose, but to understand who we are as individuals.
Knowing your roots.
Know your roots, that's right. Nothing wrong with that.
They make a whole program out of that.
That's
and who do you think you are?
Who do you think you are?
British, Australian.
Yeah. So in the Apocalypse chapter 12, and in verse 7, there is a remarkable prediction of a massive struggle that occurs in the heavens in outer space. When you see the word heaven in the book of Revelation, it is from the Hebrew, which is in the plural, not in the singular. It is heavens. It is not a battle that rages between Christ and Satan, as is so often assumed to be the case by so many unbelieving believers. Rather, it is a frightening conflagration that erupts when Michael, the archangel, declares war against the Dark Lord and his legions. And it's a war that is started by Michael, not the devil. Look at Revelation chapter 12 and verse 7. And war broke out in the heavens. Michael and his angels going forth to war against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back. Okay, here's Star Wars all over.
Michael didn't like his tone.
But it was not strong enough to win, so that there was no longer any place for them in the heavens. The great dragon was expelled, that ancient reptoid also known as the devil and Satan. Satan means adversary. The deceiver of the whole world. He was hurled down to the earth and his angels were hurled down with him. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall, as it were, to watch what was going on.
I don't think our retinas would be able to cope with that, would
they? Now, notice what many may miss. Commensurate with Satan's expulsion from outer space to this planet Earth, the very next chapter describes the rise of the Antichrist to world conquest with his faithful religious comrade. I won't turn there, but if you look at Revelation 13, verse 1, and Revelation 17, verse 8, and look at it as an overview, it occurs at the same time that Michael fights with his angels against the Dark Lord and expels him. So these events appear to be simultaneous. Therefore, it becomes quite apparent that Satan energizes this egotistic politician with a monumental demoniac power and amplifies his astonishing vision for the future of this planet under his authority and realm. Now, back up a little bit, because before that happens, Elijah, and I've pointed this out many times, Elijah comes on the world scene. Actually, it emerges in Israel. He will be ministering to the state of Israel and instituting the awesome reforms, including the revival of the Davidic theocracy and the reintroduction of Mosaic legislation as the basis for the future of the emergent religious state. At the moment, it's a secular state. It's going to change. It'll become a religious theocracy. Remember, the angel confided in Miriam that her son Yeshua would inherit the throne of his father David. Luke chapter 1, verses 32 and 33. So clearly the Messiah will not be inheriting a non-existent throne. And I'm sorry to all those British Israelites out there that want to say that London is where the throne of David is now, and the British Israelites, their replacement theology. I absolutely reject all replacement theology as being nothing but drivel from the devil's snot. Put it that way. That's how much I hold it in contempt.
Amen.
No, rather, there will be a throne in existence at his coming in a theocratic state in Israel. And you know what? They're digging at the moment in their archaeological pursuits in Jerusalem. I know they're looking for that throne of David. It was never found. It'll be there. They'll find it. They'll restore it. Literally restore it. That's my view.
Oh, but it won't have that rock. Yeah. That stone.
Yeah. the Scottish stone.
Unless then you can have it back.
Yeah.
For what it's worth.
Clearly, from the contents of the Apocalypse, the Antichrist and his religious guide will counterfeit the two witnesses, one of whom will be the reincarnated Elijah. But the Antichrist will enforce upon the entirety of the Gentile nations the Sinai Torah for unqualified dominance. Hear me. That's why it'll be used. For unqualified dominance. Mm. Recall, there is nothing wrong with the Sinai Torah as such. Certainly, we who find ourselves walking, living and breathing in God's grace can continue ahead of time to be subject to the new covenant, which will be made with Christ and Israel, with the future survivors after his second advent. That's quite true. But we can have it in anticipation. We can utilize and walk in the new covenant. Paul uses it principally to explain to the Gentiles the reason for their existence. But he also says to Timothy in 1 Timothy 1 verse 8, we know that the Torah is good. Yeah, nothing wrong with it that way. The Torah is good. If a man use it lawfully. Now, why would he say that? Let me tell you why. The Antichrist will not use the Torah lawfully, except to control others below him in rank or in view of their perceived spiritual or managerial inferiority.
This is called the lawless one.
He's called the lawless one. Why? Because he himself is above that law, but he uses it to control everyone else.
Oh, it sounds like current times, doesn't it?
Very much. We know from our studies in the Luke and Acts that the Edomite Herod utilized the Torah explicitly to exercise forthright restraint over his Jewish subjects. I want to turn to Acts 15 verse 10. It is most important because it's been misused by Protestants particularly, and I want to clarify what it actually means. Because if you look at chapter 15 of Acts and look at verse 10, this is usually used by Protestants as Peter's argument for Christian liberty. Now, therefore, why tempt you God to put a yoke upon the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear? Now, please notice the inference is that the Torah was so terrible that they couldn't bear it. It was a yoke upon them. And this is the danger of somebody opening their Bible and not having any background in being taught the Word of God. That could be used that way. It could be used that way. But if they had Josephus, a copy of Josephus, they would realize what Herod, and this is during the time of Herod, Acts 15,
yeah.
Herod used the Torah of Moses to control the state. Now, Herod was an Edomite. He was not a Jew. He was an Edomite. Idumean. And he used the Torah to govern people. He was able to control the state by having more additional burdens put onto that law to keep people in check. And Josephus says it was driving them mad. Yeah, it was. It was.
Like the work who keep coming up with a new rule all the time.
Exactly. And you know what? This is what's going to happen. It's why Christ said, don't make your flight on the Sabbath day if you're in Israel. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the Antichrist will have all these additional precepts and laws based upon the Sabbath commandment so that you will basically stay in your house all the time. You won't go out to breathe. No, there'll be a law against that. Look at the Talmud and all the laws that the rabbis put after the Herodian period upon the Jews. I've got copies, the whole volumes here. The Code of Jewish Law and all that. Where you've got to be careful how you tie your shoes. Which shoe to put on first. All this is control. My mother used to say, why are you doing this? No, the left shoe on first because if you put your feet in slippers, you've got to be careful there's no demon standing in them.
So this you must is where face, it them up, face them towards you.
Yes, you can face them towards
your bed,
yeah,
as you get up so that your feet go straight into them, because if you turn them around the other way, demons might have gotten in there,
yeah,
during
so
the
this
night.
This superstitious nonsense.
It is, isn't
It's pathetic.
I wonder either whether it's just some Jewish mothers making sure that everybody kept things tidy.
Well, that could be the that could be the case too. But this is the whole point. The Torah is good if a man uses it lawfully. We know from our studies in Acts that Herod used it to control his Jewish subjects, which is what Acts 15 is about. The Mosaic economy, necessarily revived for the purposes of temple worship by Elijah, will be saddled upon the peoples of the world as a form of outright control, and it is this key that opens up to us all the answer concerning that which is called the mark. So the mark of the beast is the keeping of the festivals and the Sabbath day and the rest of the Torah in conjunction with what the Antichrist wants us to experience.
Mm, because with all that surveillance and the facial recognition that they want to bring in worldwide that's
exactly.
been so perfected over there
yep,
with the CCP,
in China, yeah.
then you won't be able to move. I mean, it'll be monitoring you in your house.
That's right.
You know, like, Winston, I can't see you.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's coming.
And the privacy laws will have no bearing.
Oh, none whatever.
They'll be useless.
Not during that time period.
It's fairly useless now.
So that brings us to the point of asking the question of where we are today and why we are where we are. Thousands of years ago, Samael and a colony of his so-called angelic archons, powers and principalities, approximately 200 of them, left their original estate somewhere in outer space in a galaxy far, far away, and founded colonies on our planet Earth. Our unique solar system suited these creatures perfectly. You might be interested to know that last week the scientists discovered an object that has just entered our solar system, and it is huge. It's 12 miles wide, and it's got all kinds of flashing lights on it. And they're calling it a comet, but they don't know what it is, but they're calling it that, because a comet doesn't have fire at the front, it has fire at the back. So what are all these lights flashing on and off? It's 12 miles, huge, and it's entered our solar system, and it's heading our way. Now, what is this? I don't know. Could it be immediately that everything I've said about all these things have got to be brought to into an existence before Christ can return? Is God going to suddenly speed everything up? Well, it's possible. Is this Satan making his grand entrance into our solar system and heading toward us? I don't know. Has the war in heaven taken place yet? I wouldn't think so, but it's possible. Anyway, back in thousands of years ago, 200 of them left their original estate and they headed our way. And our unique solar system suited these creatures perfectly. Their invasion is described in Genesis chapter 6 and in other literature that was produced during the intertestamental period of Jewish Christian history. Contemporary science fiction theatre addicts speak of these reptilian-like humanoids as our creators. Saw a girl the other day with a t-shirt on, and on the back of it says, "Welcome, our creators." You know, they're already there. Young people are already there. But for the majority of civilians in our modern technological culture, their parallel existence remains an archaic mystery, mostly forgotten by the world, but yet somehow remaining dormant in humankind's collective unconscious, awaiting a miraculous moment of rebirth to become actively engaged and alive. This is where we are right now.
People are crying out for it. The youth are crying out for this whole new world. They think socialism's going to give it to them.
Yeah, globalism's going to give it to them. Yeah. A few years ago, we had a revolt against globalists. Remember that? They were marching up Wall Street and demanding an end to globalism. Now they're going, "We want the global economy. We want socialism."
Yes, but that was all funded by a particular man to look like a huge opposition, and it wasn't really.
That's true. We won't go into that. We don't want to get cancelled just yet. So, that original invasion actually involved the sons of God. That's what it says in Genesis chapter 6, the Bani Elohim. And they entered our environs suddenly and unannounced through a stargate atop Mount Hermon in Syria, and they then consorted with earth women because they saw them as being easy. That's a fact. Zadokite document gives you all that script. So, the biblical statement by God that he never referred to my angel, to any angel as my son, is an indication that the sons of God were in fact a race of shape-shifting humanoids, quite advanced as a species and completely differentiated from angels. Hebrews 1:5 says so. Whichever of my angels did I call my son? Asks God. Yeah, it didn't do it. So therefore, these creatures were capable of creation like the Elohim. And indeed, they are captured in just that precise terminology, being called the Bani Elohim. Okay. We can locate this occurrence as being in the seventh generation by inclusive count from Adam, and in fact, the specific mention of the name of Jared, Enoch's father, in that context, carries in his appellation the historical fact and recent memory of the descent of aliens, because Jared means the descent of the gods. In 2001, I gave the following teasers in a lecture which was based on a 1985 article I had written. Quote, certainly I have shared in sermons with hundreds of believers in all areas and all sorts of denominations over the years that one day in the near future they will go out onto their front lawn and look up and the sky will be literally filled with hundreds of large metallic grey shields or flying saucers. For the Dark Lord will have returned to gather together his lost colonies. There is no doubt that all ancient histories of civilizations such as Egypt, Babylon, China, India, Peru, Mexico, or Mexico, if you wish, all speak in terms of their relationship with the star nations and their ongoing intercourse with humankind. They speak, in other words, of an earth engagement relating to angelic history in terms of three distinct periods, period A, period B, and period C. In period A, it's invariably an age or epoch when the gods came from the stars and ruled the earth as uninvited visitors, introducing for the benefit of humankind the arts and sciences, and especially the celestial arts and sciences. Period B follows with centuries of reigns by the offspring of the gods and human women. Yes, they lived for hundreds of years. The age of the demigods, that's the king priests. When they depart, they leave a promise of a return in the far distant future. Period C. This is the era known to us for its sun or solar, divine, dynasties consisting of men and some women, they weren't exclusively men, designated to rule by the gods who had departed back to the deep stellar regions of the heavens during period B. They keep coming back. They keep coming back. Betty and Barney Hill. We should remember them. A wonderful book written many years ago called The Interrupted Journey. If you don't know about them, look it up. And also Skinwalker Ranch. But the concept of the divine right of rule comes from this period. It is during this age we find the stellar region to be a universal phenomenon with the establishment of secret religions and rites of spiritual passage for a religious elite. It is during this age we find divine dynasties claiming descent from the sun gods. Today, only the Japanese continue to worship the emperor as the son of the sun. Concerning period B, it is intriguing that all ancient histories deal with the return of the gods or star nations into our solar system from the Milky Way galaxy, or perhaps via wormholes, a more evolved galaxy outside of our own. But they leave a contingent, a base or colony, to guard and protect the secret, mysterious celestial arts and sciences from misuse by inept humans. Those left here monitor human progress. Having said that, these contingents are known for their sick and generally unhealthy physical conditions. Cripples, cases of mental derangement, deaf, blind, suffering, inability to speak, or given to incessant chattering, epilepsy, etc. Terrible injuries received as a result of enormous intergalactic battles with other higher forms of technologically advanced heavenly civilizations. And in the days of Yeshua, there was an incredible amount of demonic activity going on. Mm. So much so that almost every page of the Gospels records demonic interrelationship with the Messiah. And he's casting out of people who have become deaf. They get rid of the demon and they can hear again. Okay, that kind of thing. So, these last contingents remove themselves from the races of men and relocate in the enormous subterranean technologically advanced cities beneath the Himalayas, the Andes, the Gobi, and the three principal oceans. UFO sightings occur in more than normal density over Antarctica and the shipping lanes of the three oceans and widely across Tibet and Nepal. As to the region of Tibet, the locals acknowledge, as par for the course, that UFO sightings in the skies above them are so regular and, in fact, have been occurring for thousands of years, but nobody thinks twice about them. Westerners are completely taken by surprise at such an admission. It's interesting that consistent mention is made by ancient writers of fabulous lost cities of the East, Shangri-La, Shambhala, Agati. One no longer wonders about the authenticity of these ancient stories when we compare them with reliable eyewitness accounts of persistent UFO activity at Antarctica and in the region of Lhasa in Tibet. In fact, Lhasa is the mysterious city beneath which Noah reportedly buried the archives of the world that then was, and China's interest in Lhasa and its invasion of Tibet may very likely have a hidden agenda. Now remember, this was written in 1985. I will say this. It is an interesting aside that the Americans and the Russians have done essentially the same thing. We know for a fact the US has built an enormous underground city beneath Cheyenne Mountain in the continental United States, with secret entrances and huge underground tunnel systems to enable the president and his administration to escape Washington safely in case of an all-out thermonuclear war. Another underground city is under the Real Pine Gap in Australia. And yet another, not as large, has been constructed in Saudi Arabia. And how many more exist that we know nothing about? Unquote from my Expositions from the Vault. The Third Temple, its magnetic attraction to the angelic Elohim and the lost colonies of the Reptoid, 1985 and revised in 2001. Since this was penned, scores of data from a variety of sources have promulgated much the same as that which I and others have been speaking about since the 60s. It is intriguing, it's becoming almost common knowledge among conspiracy theorists, but to my mind, it is God who is allowing the truth to become finally widely recognized, even in the current general agnosticism of the world, so that all on planet Earth will have to enter that dark period with an immense measure of guilt for not reacting in advance in a positive way toward the God of all, seeking his salvation and mercy, and rather opting in their chosen flaccid ignorance to be enslaved by the furiously cybernetic transhumanistic Hasatan. Satan has been battling for total control of man's mind ever since Eden, and this false flag culmination will be his triumphant capture of it. To conclude, the earliest primitive mention of Satan as the adversary of humankind, as humankind, not the eternal creator God. Satan is not God's enemy. He is our enemy. He is God's tool. He is the left hand of God. Remember that. The earliest primitive mention is located in the oldest scroll of the Bible. I mentioned it before, Job. In chronological terms, the earliest scroll included in the Hebrew Bible is probably Job. It clearly predates the five scrolls of the Torah, which we locate in the beginning of the Christian Bible. Indeed, I must add that many Jewish scholars claim Job is nothing more than a fiction of genius created by a pious editor to explain the problems associated with the existence of evil in the world. The Dark Lord has had his part in causing human misery, untold suffering, hate, cases of violent death ever since Eve convinced Adam to go gourmet. Satan the devil, since Adam was toppled, has occupied the position of imperator. He is actively engaged in working out the purposes of a sovereign God, largely in his own way, and yet at the same time as the left hand of God, across the planet, and he has done so for thousands of years as the God of this world. He's even called that by Paul in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 4. But his days in that office are numbered. As the God of this present evil age and evil world, Satan can and does traverse time. If you turn over to Luke chapter 4, verse 5, and the reason I'm mentioning this, which is rudimentary to all of us, is because we need to be reminded of this fact, because we seem to happily tread along each day of the week without giving a thought to the fact we're surrounded by demonic powers and angels and Satan-inspired geniuses. In verse 5 of chapter 4 of Luke, it says, Satan took Yeshua up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time, in a single instant. The devil said to him, I shall give to you all this power and their glory, for it has been handed over to me. Please notice that, it's been handed over to me. Who by? Adam. Because Adam fell on his face. Trying to keep on that on Eve's good side, basically. She offered him that fruit and he took it. Because he saw what had happened to her and he said, I love you so much, I'm coming with you. And he lost his brilliance. It has been handed over to me. And I may give it to whoever I wish. All this will be yours if you worship me. So Satan exists day and night before the throne of glory. Revelation 12:10 says he's before the throne of glory day and night. And yet confronts Yeshua in his earthly desert temptation in Matthew 4 and Luke 4. But you compare these texts with the statement given by Satan to God of his activities when he appeared before God in the book of Job. He says, God says to Satan, where have you been? He says, oh, I've been from a flight over the earth to patrol it. That's the Hebrew. Job 1 verse 7. Check your own account and see what it says, because it should say, from a flight over the earth to patrol it. I'll be surprised if anyone has that.
Usually says to and fro, doesn't it?
Yeah, to and fro. From a flight over the earth to patrol.
What verse was it?
Job 1, verse 7. It's,
and the Lord said to Satan, whence have you come? Satan answered the Lord, from roaming about the earth and walking up and down in it.
Yeah. From a flight over the earth to patrol it, is the Hebrew. So, as the throne of God, / patrolling the earth, / in a moment of time, it is not that Satan is omnipresent or omnipresent, but rather he holds the key to time itself. And he knows how to traverse time intradimensionally. Satan is decidedly not supernatural, but he is highly super technological. My word, he is. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of official reports on UFOs, even from Air Force and commercial pilots, that have these strange craft suddenly appearing and then disappearing before their eyes. They just go straight off the radar screens. Some brave pilots have even chased them, and I say they're brave to do so. Mm-hmm. Note, too, that Satan, by his own admission, possesses the kingdoms of the entire earth. That's what he said. All of these kingdoms. They are his to do with as he wishes. That means America, Australia, Norway, Syria, Britain, the Congo, all belong to him. And I could turn to Ephesians and prove the whole point, but I think you get the message. And Paul had authority to deal directly with Satan. I don't know whether I would want that. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Verse 1. It is reported commonly that there is porneia among you, and such porneia as is not so much as named among the Gentiles, that one should have his father's wife. And you are puffed up, and you have not rather mourned that he that has done his deed might be taken away from among you. For I truly, as absent in body but present in spirit, have judged already, as though I were present, concerning him who has done this deed. Now, they were quite proud of the fact that they were so grace-filled that they accept this guy, even though he was bedding his stepmother, as it appears to be. In the name of our Lord Yeshua the Messiah, when you are gathered together, and my spirit, Paul's even putting his spirit there, with the power of our Lord Yeshua the Messiah, to deliver such a one unto Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that the spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Yeshua. In other words, he's handing him over to Hasatan. Mm-hmm. Why? To kill him. Now, everyone might say, oh, that's not a Christian attitude. Well, argue with Paul. And if you turn over to 1 Timothy, I know it's not very pleasant, but it's still the word of God. If you turn over to 1 Timothy, 1st Epistle, chapter 1, and look at verse 20. Verse 18. This charge I commit unto you, son Timothy, according to the prophecies that went before on you, that you by them might war a good warfare. Yeah, we're involved in war. We're involved in warfare. Christ was not a pacifist. I'm not a pacifist, although I was Australia's very first successful conscientious objector against the Vietnam War for my own reasons. Holding faith and a good conscience, which some having put away concerning faith have made shipwreck. They're shipwreck of their conscience. Of whom is Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have delivered unto Satan. Wow. So he had an ongoing relationship there. That they may learn not to blaspheme. Interesting. Paul had authority to deal directly with Hasatan. Daniel 12 verse 1 says, at that time, the end of the age, Michael shall arise, the great prince who defends and champions Daniel's people. And there shall be a time of unparalleled trouble, constriction, and distress, such as never was since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be rescued, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book, that is, of God's plan for his own. That ultimate distress, which is promised by God to come upon the earth, will eventuate as a consequence of war in space between the technologically advanced legions of the angel Michael and the super mammoth metallic spacecraft and battle-hardened stormtroopers of the Dark Lord Hasatan. When the power of Michael is unleashed in its full fury, Satan, caught off guard by the super agent or archangel of Yahweh, will retreat with the military remains of his exhausted personnel directly to planet Earth, where he will be welcomed by the ultra-terrestrial occupants of his old, battered, post-deluge colonies, which have been stationed here for millennia. This outcome is outlined in John's Apocalypse, chapter 12. As he flees to his doom, the great reptoid will be accompanied by his awesome military force that had previously been seized from heaven when the man-child was born in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago. If you turn to Revelation 12, verse 4, that mentions that at the time of the birth of Christ, Satan leaves heaven. As he goes, he seizes one-third of all of God's angels. Now, this is this is unbelievable, but it is very believable. He seizes them against their will. Fully a third of the angels of Yehovah were taken into service against their will, and they remain in his administration to this present day. They have no choice in the matter. They will accompany Satan in his rapid, fiery descent to our planet. Vast civilizations across the expansive galaxies will rejoice when they hear the announcement that Satan has been routed for good from their imprisoned subservience. But the Ruach of the Lord Yehovah warns the inhabitants of our blue planet in verse 12 of chapter 12 of Revelation, woe to you, inhabitants of earth, because the devil went down to you having anger, an enormous wrath, knowing he has but a little time left. Doesn't the devil read the Bible? How come he doesn't believe the apocalypse in chapter 12? Because it tells him all about what's going to happen to him. So I have no idea how that can be the case, but it is. One of those powers that has roamed earth since his rebellion against the Creator in the 6th century BCE is known to us today as Moloch. Moloch will greet Satan when he lands. He is one of the chief cherubim of the Jerusalem temple, known to us as the King of Tyre, utterly disqualified from temple service. He will be instrumental in the life of the Antichrist and will take over his body in the company of Satan, the Dark Lord. In effect, the Antichrist will be a counterfeit of the true Christ, inasmuch as he will become a triune being, a trinity, as a counterfeit of triunity. In fact, spirit, Satan, soul, Moloch, and the physical body, Mr. Antichrist. When the ark is restored to the Jerusalem temple, and the Antichrist makes his move to occupy it, remember, only one cherub will remain with the enormous wingspan that will cover the same ark. It may well be the case that the future forces of the Antichrist could be the unit that will discover the ark with the remains of the abominable cherub in the cave on Mount Nebo. He could then place it in a new third temple, even though the one cherub who was disqualified for his rebellion against the Creator would take his place once more in that sacred space of the Elohim. As such, it would not only appear as an abomination, but would be a literal abomination for it to be there. But to show God's supposed approval, the sacred text states that the associated false prophet of the Antichrist will cause fire to descend in the sight of men, Revelation 13, 11, 12, and 13. In order to grant the ark with this abomination overspreading it, a God-appointed authorization. What an immense evil is this. Still, it remains that God could permit this as a part of his own perfectly arranged great delusion. Prophecy, in the last instance, can only be perfectly understood after the events foretold and not exclusively prior to them. But the Ruach of God, the Holy Spirit, nevertheless leads us into all the truth. In our following lecture, we shall discuss the possibility that authentic believers who are daily growing into the likeness of their Lord, Saviour, Messiah, and Rabbi Yeshua will actually be protected during the reign of the Antichrist and thus avoid the horror of martyrdom. For decades, I have postulated the opposite. I may well have been in error on this matter, and therefore we shall research and meditate afresh on this intriguing likelihood. Stay tuned. This ends the current lecture. Are there any questions on any of that? Baruch Hashem. Thank God.
That time the holy place will be unholy. Absolutely.
Absolutely unholy. So the temple of God in Jerusalem, the third temple, will become the temple of Hasatan.